What if the U.S. had started social distancing sooner?
Researchers at Columbia University did the math and estimate that acting just 1 week earlier could have saved tens of thousands of American lives.
I'm Noelle King here with Steve Inskeep, and this is Up First from NPR News. In many cities, the number of new coronavirus cases is declining, but in a handful of cities, the numbers have not gone down. Why is that?
Also, a war crimes trial has resumed. The trial is in Germany. The defendants are former officials from Syria. Victims are testifying to thousands of counts of torture, murder, and sexual assault.
It made us all aware again of what is actually at stake here.
What is the evidence against a former Syrian colonel and a former checkpoint guard? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals. CFP professionals are trained to provide holistic financial planning in your best interest. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
The United States is approaching 100,000 deaths from COVID-19, the most by far of any nation on Earth. This milestone is an occasion to ask what might have been done differently.
Some new analysis offers an answer. Researchers at Columbia University did some modeling, one estimate of what might have been. In their scenario, they asked, what if social distancing had been enforced across the country a week sooner? They found that 36,000 fewer people would have died.
NPR global health correspondent Nurit Eisenman has been covering this story, and she's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How did researchers reach that quite dramatic number?
So the lead researcher, Jeffrey Shaman, has been putting together one of the more prominent disease models in this pandemic. And for this analysis, he and his collaborators used a similar approach. They basically looked at the data that we have to date for each county in the United States, how many confirmed cases, how many deaths, as well as factors like how dense is the county, how do people commute to work, driving cars or taking the bus.
Sure.
And from all that, they estimated how fast the coronavirus was spreading at various points in time. And they found that from March 15th on, the rate really slowed due to people beginning to social distance in a big way, voluntarily or due to stay-at-home rules. So then they calculated, what if that behavior had kicked in a week earlier on March 8th? They found a week makes a huge difference. We would have had 55% fewer deaths through May 3rd. Mm. And with a two-week head start, we would have had 83% or nearly 54,000 fewer deaths.
Yeah, because it's just math. It's like compound interest. A couple fewer cases a couple months ago might be many fewer cases now. But I guess we should note that things looked very different back in, say, early March. It might have been hard to make that decision back then.
Right. And even if officials had taken action sooner, would people have complied to the same degree? Here's what Shaman, the researcher, had to say about it.
The reality is that, you know, the United States has had a very cushy existence since World War II. We've not had a lot of things that required a lot of sacrifice. We've not been primed for dealing with or thinking about infectious diseases.
So he says whether there would have been the political will or the public will to take action earlier is up for debate. Of course, it's worth pointing out that leaders in some countries, South Korea, Germany, New Zealand, the leaders there did make the case to their citizens earlier on, and they've benefited. They have far fewer cases and deaths per capita than the U.S.
And you just named three countries that have democratic systems. They weren't authoritarian governments. They were able to persuade people to do this. But now, of course, we have done weeks of social distancing. What's the analysis show about the future?
Yeah, the study also runs simulations to see, now that we're opening up again, if we do have a rebound of cases, how big of a difference will it make if we act immediately or if we wait? And again, because this virus spreads exponentially, as little as a week or two can result in significantly more deaths. Here's Shaman again.
We have to be so responsive and so attentive to what's going on and able to quickly identify when there's a resurgence of the infection in a community and to respond to it quickly and to have the will to do so and not repeat our mistakes.
And he says for that, we still need a much more robust system than we currently have for testing to identify people, contact tracing, helping people quarantine and isolate.
Nurit, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Nurit Eisenman. OK, Okay, the numbers are getting better in the United States, but why are some metro areas improving more rapidly than others?
It's an important question. Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force said this week that three numbers are declining nationwide. There are fewer new cases, fewer people are going into the hospital, and fewer people are dying. That's good news. But she said there are three areas where cases have plateaued. They're holding steady and not declining. Those are Washington, D.C., Chicago, and L.A.
NPR's Melissa Block is in one of those three areas, Washington, D.C. Hi there, Melissa.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, what does it mean that coronavirus is not going up, but it's plateauing, they say, in Chicago, L.A., and D.C.?
Yeah, I think that comment from Dr. Birx is a bit of a head-scratcher. I think of plateau, and I think of something totally flat. And in all these places, really, the trend lines are going down, maybe just not as sharply as in other cities. Take Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has said the city is on track to meet its targets for reopening, and she points to barometers like sustained decrease in community spread of the virus for 10 days. The goal is to get to 14 days. She says in terms of testing capacity, hospital capacity, they're on track there. So they are on the right track, she says, haven't seen as steep of a decline as they would like. So she has extended the stay-at-home order in D.C. until June 8th.
And the surrounding areas, Washington, D.C., of course, is surrounded by Virginia and Maryland. They've also kept stay-at-home orders in place, right?
Right. And as you know, this is one intensely interconnected community, people going back and forth and a lot of mobility. Prince George's County, Maryland, for example, surrounds about half of Washington, D.C. It's overwhelmingly communities of color, mostly African American and Hispanic, that have been disproportionately hit by the virus. I spoke with Dr. Joseph Wright at the University of Maryland Capital Region Health System in PG County. He's the chief medical officer there. He calls PG County the epicenter of the epicenter, and said that they've had what he calls a tsunami of COVID patients coming through their door. So I asked him if they are past their peak. Here's what he said.
Sometimes you can only appreciate the peak in the rearview mirror. We have just now, just literally this week, seen a flattening of our local health system curve.
And like a lot of people that I talk to, Steve, he is very worried about this holiday weekend, Memorial Day, with a lot of people out and about. He's worried that that flattened curve could spike upward again.
Okay, so there's concern, but D.C. is actually on a trend slightly downward, not entirely flat. What about Los Angeles and Chicago, the other cities that Birx mentioned?
Well, our colleague Adrian Florida reports that in L.A. County, the number of hospitalizations of COVID patients is decreasing every day. The rate of transmission has dropped quite a bit. That's the number of people that each person who's infected with coronavirus then passes the virus on to. Back in March, before California put stay-at-home orders in place, each infected person in LA was infecting about 3.5 people. Now officials say that number has fallen to less than one, so that's a good indicator. And it'll be important to keep that rate low if LA plans to stick to its plan to have most of its economy back up and running by July 4th. Then there's Chicago, and NPR's David Shaper has been looking into that. Same thing there. Statewide numbers for Illinois, and that's essentially a proxy for Chicago, since almost all the cases that have tested positive are in Chicago. According to the public health director there, the numbers are trending down. So a little bit of a problem of trying to figure out what Deborah Birx means by plateauing.
Well, thanks for the fact check there, Melissa. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
That's NPR's Melissa Block. All right, there is other news in the world, including a trial that resumed in Germany.
That's right. Two defendants are on trial for war crimes. They're both former members of Syria's military. These men fled to Germany along with refugees, and they claimed asylum there. But then authorities learned about their past and accused them of crimes against humanity. Prosecutors have linked them to systematic torture conducted by Syria's government.
NPR's Deborah Amos has covered Syria's war for years and is on the line. Deb, good morning.
Good morning.
What's happened so far in this trial?
So, as you said, it began last month, resumed this week. And it's remarkable because for the first time, these former Syrian officials are confronted by Syrian torture victims in person in court. One of them accused is a former colonel. The other is a checkpoint guard. When the indictment was read out in court, the victims heard a summary of their testimony. One horrible crime after the other, says German attorney Patrick Croker, who represents them.
There were very emotional reactions. I was sitting in front of our clients. I checked every once in a while. I saw that they were, finding it difficult But in the end, they were really happy that they were there. It made us all aware again of what is actually at stake here.
The main defendant, Anwar Ruslan, he's in his late 50s, was in charge of interrogation in a prison known as Branch 251 when the uprising began in Syria. He gave his first statement in court this week. It was read by his lawyer. He denied all charges. He said there were criminals that took over his prison. They ignored his complaints about brutal treatment. "It wasn't me," is his defense. And this is a trial that could take more than a year.
Well, how much evidence is there that it was him?
There's a lot. There's testimony from a German immigration official who said he started hearing about Anwar Ruslan from arriving refugees. There are official documents that were smuggled out of Syria that shows that Ruslan signed his name to reports that went all the way up the chain of command. Those documents do not explicitly mention torture, according to sources who've seen that. The Assad regime has long denied that there's any torture in the country.
So these two defendants, as we mentioned, were plucked out of the flow of Syrian refugees to Germany, hundreds of thousands of people. What do the other refugees have to say about it?
So activists in Germany are trying to get the details to their community from German to Arabic, as the court has done. One is Wafa Mustafa. She's an activist. She was speaking on a Zoom conference call from Berlin this week. She knows that there is a painful process of managing expectations. Her father is still detained, and somehow she hoped that the trial would speed his release.
For a second, I definitely thought so. But then I also told myself that definitely it's needed to have hope, but it's also needed to have patience. I myself might not see the day that justice will be achieved in Syria. It's satisfying enough that I know that someone will.
Also satisfying, she said, as others said in this conference, it's the first time that the victims have a voice in seeking justice.
Well, Deborah, thanks for listening to them. Always appreciate your reporting.
Thank you.
NPR's Deborah Amos. And that's up first for this Thursday, May 21st. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King, and we would love it if you start your day here with us again tomorrow. And we know that the news does not stop when this podcast is over, so you can follow us on Twitter at UpFirst, where we tweet the news.
Or you can just turn on the radio. NPR's Morning Edition is on your NPR station. If you're not familiar with that station, go to stations.npr.org and find out where it is. Also for podcasts, local news, and the latest headlines, take NPR everywhere with the NPR One app, which is in your app store.
On Bullseye this week, Tina Fey. On creating Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, 30 Rock, and being the best at everything.
There was a window of time when we would just go to awards things and pick up our prizes and party with the people from Mad Men.
That's this week on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.